The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi, this is episode 9 of Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. I'm Jeanette Garcia. I'll be the new narrator with Louis Rez. He's going to tell me all about these interesting stories, and I'm going to learn a whole lot. So let's have it, Louis.
Okay. It's very nice to be with you, Jeanette, and welcome to the Miami Memoirs podcast, number 9. And this story is called Mr. Ulitzy, and it comes from my book, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. And I think you were talking to me before about how I got started.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about how you got into law. And was it a family business, or how did it come about?
Well, it's the great American story, the Statue of Liberty, where your forefathers, of course, we all came over from foreign countries. The DuPonts came over from France, you know. And so my family came over from Lithuania, and father became an attorney. He was my father was the only one in his large family that actually went to college. Nobody else in the family was ever a professional man, you know, like a doctor or a lawyer or a dentist. They all came from Lithuania, and for the most part, they got into the coffee and tea business, wholesale coffee and tea. And then in those days, people brewed their own. They didn't have instant, and they didn't have packaged, and they didn't have the coffee makers. So people brewed their coffee and bought the coffee and tea, the beans, ground beans. My dad went to Brooklyn Law School, and I think he went at night, and he had to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge to go to school. And he ate 1-cent sandwiches, and he struggled. Do you know what a 1-cent sandwich is?
No, what is that?
You ever hear of a 1-cent sandwich?
No.
Well, a 1-cent sandwich with 2 pieces of white bread and with nothing in between. They used to call it a jam sandwich because there were 2 pieces of white bread jammed together. 2-cent sandwiches were for the rich. The 2-cent sandwiches had a piece of bologna in the middle, a slice of bologna. Anyhow, my dad graduated, and it was a struggle. It's a terrible struggle to start a law practice on your own if you don't have family connections or business connections or friends, and it was a struggle. My dad had a small law office on Court Street in Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn. And that was in the 1930s. And he just had, in his office, he just had room for his desk and a chair. And that was it. And 2 client chairs. And he shared a reception room with another lawyer. And he shared a secretary. They had 1 secretary for the 2 of them. And the secretary turned out to be my father's sister, Bertie. And my dad used to come home and tell us stories at dinner. And this was, of course, before television. So we sat around the table. They had radio, but nobody played the radio at dinner. For some reason, we still don't do it. You can leave the TV on nowadays, but you don't leave the radio on while you're having dinner.
That's true.
So we sat around and we had these discussions. We don't seem to do that today. And we talked about current events. And my dad always was asked and told us what he did that day in the office. We were always interested. And he would tell us stories. Well, one of the best stories was how he was sitting at his desk early one morning when a client came rushing in wearing only pajamas and slippers. He was quite agitated. He was shaking from head to toe. And he kept shouting, "Mr. S, Mr. S, I love you, Mr. S, I love you." And then he drops to his knees in front of the desk, my father's desk, and he says to my father, "Mr. S, you are my God. You are my God. You save my life. You save my life." "Mr. Ulitzy, take it easy. Take it easy. Are you all right? What happened?" Mr. Ulitzy remains on his knees, and he looks up at my father with wide eyes, and he's shaking, and his hands are clasped over his chest. And he says, "Mr. S, I was in Long Island, and in my car, I'm driving. I'm coming up to Long Island, the railroad, to the crossing. And I look to the left, and I look to the right, and I start across the tracks. She's all clear. And then I see this big black train. She's coming down on me fast. I know I'm going to die. So I say, 'Mr. S, my attorney, what do I do? What do I do?' And you answer me. You say, 'Mr. Ulitzy, Mr. Ulitzy, throw yourself on the floor of the car. Throw yourself on the floor.' So I always follow your advice, and I throw myself on the floor of the car. The train, she comes like lightning, and she smashes my car. Everything goes black. I wake up in the hospital, but I'm okay. They won't let me out. I have to stay under observation. I say to myself that I must go to see Mr. S and thank him. So I get out of bed and I climb out the window. There's a fire escape. And I go down to the street and I take a taxi to you. Thank you, Mr. S. Thank you, Mr. S. Mr. S, you saved my life. You are my God. You are my God.
Wow. He really, I mean, you literally saved his life.
Well, it was my dad, and it was a true story. Mm-hmm. So that's what hooked me. When I heard those stories, I said, wow, this is fun.
You know, yeah.
I wasn't dreaming of sitting out trials, waiting for juries to come in multi-million dollar cases, sweating it out. But it was, these stories were so warm and so human mm-hmm. that I said, wow, this is for me. I'll practice with my father and everything will be great. Didn't turn out that way. It turned out that my father could barely support himself. And he certainly couldn't have me as an associate. I graduated. I went to a very prestigious law school, Cornell Law School.
Oh,
we
yeah.
started with, I think, 130 in the class and 47 graduated. It was the paper chase. You know mm-hmm. what that was?
No. What's that?
Paper chase is where you look to your left and you look to your right and only one of the three of you was going to make it out
oh,
of the school.
It's tough.
It was hazing. It was terrible. It was
highly competitive, I'm sure.
Highly competitive and mean. And everybody, I was on the board of trustees at one time later on in my life, and I said, what is the SAT requirement, the LSAT requirement? What percentile do you have to be in to get into the Cornell Law School? They said, oh, 96 percentile. I said, then how come half your kids are flunking out?
Yeah.
They changed the rules after that, and they provided that everybody graduates. They just need a little helping hand or guidance, and the school has an obligation to find out why the student isn't happy or functioning mm-hmm. and help the student. But in those days, it was to judge and punish.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyhow, you know, my dad told these stories, and it describes a trust between the lawyer and the client. That's what the Mr. Ulitzy story is about. He loved my father. He was his God. He listened to him. And my dad helped him. And even when he needed guidance from above, he turned to his lawyer. Well, nowadays, it's a different relationship. And we have problems with ethics and client-attorney relationships. And I was telling you about some of these conflicts. For example, if you previously represented one party, you can't sue them. Let's say you represented a husband and wife in drawing a will, mm-hmm. and you drew their wills, and now they're getting a divorce. You can't represent the husband or the wife against the other one because you were the attorney mm-hmm. For each of them in the past. Well, that goes to a lot of things, conflicts of interest. Nowadays, you have to have a computer, and you have to put it into the computer. All the clients, including the corporations that you represent or have represented in the past, and then if they come in for legal advice, you have to see whether or not you represented a conflicting party.
Of course, yeah.
You may have sued the corporation in the past, and now the corporation is asking you to represent them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different kind of a conflict. That can be waived.
Oh,
it
can?
That's not an issue. Yeah.
Oh,
because that was something in the past, and you're representing them for the future.
Hmm.
But if you...
But you're on the opposite side, aren't
right,
you?
Right. If you're suing them... And you've represented them in the past, they might not be happy because you have an insight as to what their internal operation is. So we have a computer that keeps track of all the clients, and you may have to make sure. I can tell you some of the other conflicts that lawyers have, you know. Let's say you're in a criminal trial, and you have two defendants in the criminal trial, are each charged in this crime doing it together, a burglary, let's say. You can't represent them both because at one point in time, the state's attorney or the prosecutor might come to you and say, well, we're willing to make a plea deal with one of
yes,
them,
of course.
But he's got to testify against the other.
That's not going to work.
Well, how can you encourage one client
of course.
to cop a plea against the other client who you're representing? So that's an example of it. Also, corporations. You put your own stock in the corporation. Judges have this problem, too.
Hmm.
Let's say the judge owns stock in Ford Motor Company, or the lawyer does, and he wants to sue them. Well, if he's got an interest in the company, he's suing against his own economic interest.
Right.
But if it's Ford Motor Company and you own less than 5% of the stock, then they waive that. That's not a conflict. So it's usually a 5% rule.
I see.
If you are on the board of directors of a company, you can't sue them. There's a lot of attorneys go on the board of directors, which is a big mistake, by the way, for an attorney to represent, be the attorney for the company, and also be on the board of directors.
Oh, yeah, that sounds complicated.
Well, you can't give them legal advice, because on the board of directors, you're sworn to work for the company. And as a lawyer, you may say, you're doing this wrong, you can't do
exactly
this.
Right.
So it's a conflict. We get down to retainer agreements, and this is what's going on nowadays with client relationships. When you represent a client, you should have, in fact, you're required to have a written agreement. It's called a retainer. And at the end of the case, you're very wise to have a closing letter or closing agreement so that you don't get sued for malpractice later on.
I see.
And
that
they waive any conflicts that they may have had along the way. So a closing document is very good that nobody seems to know about. Also, and I asked a lot of big firms in a seminar once that I conducted on ethics, what do you do to have your new clients represented at the time you sign a retainer? The retainer spells out the relationship between the attorney and the client. And it says the fees, whether it's hourly or a contingent fee, which I prefer to hourly.
What's that? What's a contingent?
It's based on the results of the case. For example, in an automobile accident, you get a third or 25% or 40%, it used to be, if you go through a trial or an appeal, of
and
the gross amount that you recover.
And that's definitely helpful for those who, you know, don't have the income to be able to hire representation.
Exactly. The law practice is really a manifestation and a reflection of society, and it's not an even playing field.
Mm-hmm.
So the rich people who can afford the best attorney, the most expensive attorneys, which turn out generally to be the best attorneys,
yes,
they can rule the roost. They can dominate, and they have money to pay expert witnesses, and they have money to do research, and they have money to write briefs, and they have money to take appeals, and they have money to pay for transcripts of records and take depositions and pay for investigators. So those things are keys in the handling of a case. And that's very, very, very important. So the contingent fee is so much better because the lawyers then lay out the money for all these expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, also people don't realize that a lawyer can go bankrupt doing that.
Because they're putting down their own.
Yeah, one of my good acquaintances represented a man who was in a malpractice case, and he had to have a tracheotomy, and he was paralyzed from it, and he claimed that it wasn't done properly. He spent $400,000 of his own money, and that was like 30 years ago.
That's awful.
Running around the country to learn about the case to see if he could get witnesses and.
I mean, that's wonderful of him, though. He truly wanted to help. So.
Then he lost the case. And then he lost $400,000.
Oh, no. Hopefully he got it back somehow because he sounds wonderful. He tried to help him.
I congratulated him on taking the case in the first place because it took guts to undertake a case. So now you look at cases and you say, well, what's my chance of winning?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of how can I help the client, it's how can I win and make a fee?
That's
different,
pretty sad.
Different goal, different ethics.
Mm-hmm.
So also in these agreements, so I said to these law firms, all of you are guilty of an ethical violation. Well, they got very offended and never invited me back to the seminar to give another seminar because they were very aloof and very proud. And I said, when you sign an agreement, a retainer agreement with the client, who is representing the client? And they said, well, we have a standard form. And it's, I said, that's not the question. Suppose you have a dispute resolution clause in there saying that they waived the jury trial or that they agreed to mediation or that they agreed to have it resolved by arbitration or they agreed to have the dispute resolved by the Florida Bar or the other appropriate bar association. They don't know what they're doing. Who's representing them? Do you have someone in your firm that's assigned an ombudsman? No one's representing them. Well, if it's a corporation, which is often the case in a big law firm, if a corporation is retaining you, they have corporate counsel, house counsel. So house counsel looks at it. So that's okay. But an individual, they don't have any house counsel.
They have no one. No
recourse. Who's going to bargain?
Mm-hmm.
And the law firm says, look, this is our form. Take it or leave it. We don't change it for anybody. These are our fees, and this is what we do. And you waive all these rights, any conflicts you waive, and they put that in there. So that's a very one-sided arrangement.
I have a question. Did you ever have an instance where it was a conflict of interest and you tried to work around it somehow?
Sure. When you have a conflict of interest, there are three or four ways of handling it. The first thing to do is to admit it and bring it to the client's attention. Don't hide it. Don't be opaque. You've got to be open about it.
Yes.
And the second thing is to see if it's waivable. A lot of conflicts are not waivable. It's like sometimes getting into a business deal with a client where the client says, why don't you come in and buy some stock or take a piece of this real estate deal or take your fee in part of the deal. You have a conflict problem. Then you have a different economic interest than you do as an attorney when you're an investor. Mm-hmm. So you can waive a lot of that. So you draw up a waiver, and it has to be a knowledgeable waiver. Your client may have to get an attorney to sign off on the waiver. So now you got two attorneys. Then you get problems with attorney's fees. You know, we were talking about hourly. Mm-hmm. Well, if I were teaching in a law school, there would be one course on legal billing that the lawyers would take.
Yeah.
And I don't know of a lawyer around that I've ever met who wouldn't have gotten an A+ in that because they are crackerjacks at billing.
Yeah.
Boy, can they bill. And so there are a lot of tricks in billing. And that who's representing the client? You get the bill, the monthly bill, and it says review of file, telephone conferences, legal research, .. 14 hours. You don't know how many hours were put in.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of knowing. And it's a commingling of telephone calls you can time. You can say, well, I spoke to you on the phone. That phone call took 15 minutes and you billed me 2 hours. That you can keep track of.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mixed and mingled with other things. Legal research. Well, how long does it take you to...
That's subjective. Yeah, it can vary.
Once had an insurance company tell me, look, we hire you because you're supposed to know the law. We're not paying you to look it up.
They have a point.
That's part of it. Then you get into contingent fees, which has other problems. When do you settle? I'll tell you when you settle. A lot of cases are settled when the lawyer, on a contingent fee basis, has to make an alimony payment to his wife. And he needs the money. He needs the fee. He comes to the client and says, gee, this is a great time to settle. That's when you settle. So the client's interests aren't the foremost factor in entering into a settlement agreement. The foremost factor becomes the attorney's economic interest or need.
Mm-hmm.
And the attorney says, well, let's take a go at this. I got a shot at the $10 million verdict. And if I lose, I can afford to lose. Well, the client doesn't feel that way.
Yeah,
so you wind up with these conflicts. Mm-hmm. And in general, they're big problems. Then you have another thing in there where in a lot of agreements, the prevailing party gets attorney's fees, particularly in a marital settlement. If you have an issue.
What does prevailing party mean?
That's a good question because nobody knows.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Well, you go in front of the judge and you say, we had 5 issues between this husband and the wife.
Mm-hmm.
And we prevailed on 3 and they prevailed on 2. So we are the prevailing party. We won on the 3 issues. You had to pay more child support, you had to pay more alimony, and we got some real property that was an issue on the title. We cleared that up. And the other side says, wait a minute, we had 2 items that we were successful on. You had to pay the medical bills we collected from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the judge then has to determine who is the prevailing party. There's no definition.
I see.
Nobody knows this.
So the judge always makes that determination.
Well, he has to because he has to award the fees.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody's going to voluntarily say, okay, I'm going to pay you unless they want to settle it. Sometimes the cost, and that I'll get into, sometimes the cost of winning exceeds the cost of settling.
Right.
And you have nothing.
More time litigating and everything.
Yeah. So you have to determine who is the prevailing party. Well, the general rule is the judge determines what the major issue was. What was the real thrust of the issues? And on that issue, who prevailed? So the judge may say, all these issues about late payments of alimony and about child support aren't important. The real issue here was the sale of this property. And that one, X one, the husband or the wife, and that's where I'm going to award the fee. Well, then they say, judge, you have to prorate the time that the lawyer spent on that issue as opposed to all the other issues in the case.
Wow.
And he can only be compensated for that time.
I see.
So, that's
so sometimes, doesn't quite work out.
Issue.
Yeah, huge
that's
conflict of interest there.
Well, the judge then hears what is a reasonable fee. So the lawyer has to testify. Well, the lawyer testifies, but he needs an expert because the lawyer can't. The lawyer's word is subjective. He's trying to make money or she's trying to make money. So they have to bring in an expert. So they bring in a former judge to testify.
I see.
Well, come in as an expert witness and testify as to attorney's fees. Well, they do that. And they say, Judge, in my opinion, $100,000 would be a reasonable fee. And then the other side cross-examines him and says, wait a minute, that's crazy. I have an expert. My expert is a former judge who says $25,000 would be a reasonable fee. And then the judge has to make a determination. Well, okay, the judge says, I'm going to award $75,000. Who's the prevailing party on the attorney's fee issue? Because the judge has to award costs, and all the fees for the experts have to be paid.
Of course.
So it's a trial within a trial. Well, now your attorney says, I'm not going to do this on a contingent basis. You're going to have to pay me by the hour. And I charge $400 an hour, let's say. And I've got 20 hours to prepare and try this. Oh, okay, 15 hours. Okay, 10 hours. Okay, that's $4,000 you're going to have to pay me. Well, the whole attorney's fee thing may be $30,000, and you don't know how much you're going to collect. And then you don't know if you're going to collect it. And then the fee is not awarded against the attorney, it's awarded against the client. So then the client files a bankruptcy and doesn't pay you. So,
how have you gone about that? What have you seen? What's the best way to sort of navigate that?
Well, the best way, in my opinion, is to resolve the issues. And I like to go to mediation. And you pay a mediator and you all sit down and try to resolve it. And each attorney tells the client, look, it's going to take time away from your business, time away from your life. It's a thorn in your side. It's going to cost you money no matter what. But you never know what the judge is going to rule. And here you are running up a big bill. It's not worth the risk. There's a proposal to settle it. Let's take a look at it and be reasonable. So I would say a good 80% of the time, issues can be resolved through settlement negotiations, and mediation is a good way to do it, provided you have a competent mediator, not a slouch. So then you have attorney's fees under 59-105, which is the federal statute, really. It's a state statute and federal, where they're punitive in nature. Let's say one side files some papers that are groundless, totally groundless. They know better. They know that the bill has been paid. They say, the wife says, you didn't pay the electric bill. And the husband says, what do you mean? I've got a receipt for it. I told you I paid it. Here's the check. And they don't drop it. If you don't drop it, I'm going to. And the wife says, I hate you so much. I hate you. I want to go get him. I don't care if he paid it. Get it. And of course, they move for attorney's fees against the wife and the wife's attorney for filing a pleading, knowing that the bill was paid, and pursuing it to a hearing. And then at the hearing say, okay, we'll drop it as a form of harassment. So then the attorney has to pay 50% usually of the amount that the judge awards as punitive attorney's fees for filing of groundless papers. So that's, in general, the nature of the attorney's fees issue. There's also a lot of stuff going on that I really haven't spoken to you about concerning what I call contracts of adhesion or unethical contracts. And that's a whole separate thing that is the lawyers are bad because they put these things in. But for example, when they sold a computer, they used to put on the inside, print on the inside of the box, on the flap, a clause saying that if you have a complaint about this computer of any type, you have to file a claim in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and pay
$2,000. Completely unreasonable.
And put in conditions. You waive jury trial. You agree to arbitration. And the worst one, and it still exists, the worst one are the stockbrokers, and they get away with it. So if you have a claim against your stockbroker for, let's say, failing to follow instructions or not advising you when the stock was plummeting, or putting you into a stock knowing that his company was selling, owned the stock and was selling it to you, and you weren't buying it on the open market, if you have a claim like that, you look in your brokerage contract that you sign when you retain the broker. They're all the same. The brokers all got together and they all agreed, and I think it's illegal, to compel everyone who deals with a registered stockbroker to sign the same form. And it says that you agree to have your disputes resolved in arbitration before a certain arbitration group. And that arbitration group is controlled by the stockbrokers.
How convenient.
And they serve on there so that if you're going against one, let's say Morgan Stanley or something, the one from another company, from Wells Fargo or something, is on that board.
And how is this
and they
legal?
serve to look after one another.
How is this legal?
It shouldn't be. It is. And it's terrible. Look, if you look on a ticket when you park your car, it says we're not responsible for any damage or loss of anything. So they leave your car open on the street. It's a convertible with the top down and your stuff in the back seat and it's stolen. And then they say we're not responsible. Look at what the ticket says. So those are kind of, or the sign in your pocket says not responsible for any damage to your car. So this is a big thing. Movie tickets. The worst one is Disney cruises. If you go on a Disney cruise, when you come on the ship, they make you sign a document. And right in there, it says, we're not responsible for any poisoning or illness you get from the meals.
Oh, boy.
So take a look. Anyhow, those are
the... read the fine print always.
Yeah, those are the problems that you have.
And what were they called again? One more time?
Contracts of adhesion. Because
adhesion.
You don't negotiate. It's given to you. It's a fait
accompli.
You have
no choice.
Here it is. And it's on there. And then they say, well, when you accepted it and allowed us to park your car, you agree to all the terms in that.
Yeah, that's it. You can't say anything about it.
Oh, you have to, when you go get your ticket to park your car, you have to take a pen, ballpoint pen, put a line through all those clauses and say, I don't agree, and see what happens. Sometimes they'll tell you to take your car elsewhere. sometimes they laugh, but that's what's going on. So I think I've covered most of this area pretty carefully. There's another thing, another area of the law that very few people are aware of. That concerns me very much. And that is insurance companies providing attorneys to their insureds when their insureds are sued. Let's say you're in an automobile accident and you have a company, let's say Liberty Mutual. And Liberty Mutual, you're being sued for $100,000. And Liberty Mutual assigns an attorney to you. And they provide you with an attorney. Well, that attorney is paid by Liberty Mutual, not by you. And that attorney is supposed to listen to you and follow your needs. But if the adjuster who gives him a lot of business from Liberty Mutual calls him and says, look, Hank, I think you ought to plead this or avoid
course,
this or admit this or fight this. He does what he's told by Liberty Mutual, not by you, but he's representing you.
So
he's got a conflict of interest.
Right. And how is that not sort of taken care of?
It's another example of inequities of bad things. And there's worse, there are more things to it. Suppose you have a claim where you want to get it settled. They want $1 million and you've got a $100,000 policy. They're willing to take the $100,000 to settle if you tender your policy limits. And Liberty Mutual says, the hell with it, we want to try the case. Your attorney's got to write a letter to Liberty Mutual saying, we hereby demand that you tender the policy limits or you're in bad faith. For failure. Well, when he does that, Liberty Mutual says, what are you doing? You're working for us. You can't write us that letter. How dare you? Or worse than that, suppose Liberty Mutual actually owns your law firm. You don't have an independent attorney.
Yeah.
They own the law firm.
There's
and the law
you can
firm
do about
does
it.
All their work. They get paid a salary, but it's owned by Liberty Mutual.
And this happens all the time.
It happens all the time. Yes.
And is it the same for, let's say, like home insurance as well?
It happens in all kinds of insurance.
All kinds.
But if you're sued, somebody falls in your house, trip and fall in your house, they provide you with an attorney. And you want to get it settled. The attorney says, no, we're going to try it. The insurance company doesn't want to settle it. Or with doctors, they say, we're going to settle this malpractice case. The doctor says, I don't want it settled. I have to report all my settlements to the Department of Professional Regulation. And after a while, I'm going to be suspended. I can't afford to have a settlement. I want the case tried. They say, no, we're going to settle. So you have a conflicting interest between the insurance company and the insured. And I think we're back to blind faith in the attorney. And it comes around in a circle. It's very interesting. And the circle says, what do you do when you have conflicts with your attorney? And why is it much more prevalent today? Because it's a much more complicated society. And these problems are not being solved. They're
and
hard
who,
to solve.
Who can solve these problems? I guess lawyers? Well, can lawyers take up cases
called,
to go against this?
You know, there's something called professionalism. And the courts have taken to it. And the courts now look at things a little more thoroughly than they had in the past. And they say, what you're doing is unprofessional. What you're doing is not acceptable to the courts. You have to remember, judges are lawyers generally. So you don't have to be, by the way. You can be a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States and not be a lawyer. Did you know
that? No, I didn't.
Well, now you do.
I thought everyone had
no,
a dealer.
No.
Oh.
United States Supreme Court justices and associate justices do not have to be a lawyer.
What are some other occupations of that they've had that you know of?
Oh, well, you could be a politician and be appointed.
Oh, boy.
But I don't know that this.
I don't know that I want a politician as a judge.
I don't know any associate justice or justice of the United States Supreme Court who wasn't an attorney. I can't think of any right offhand.
So most of them are.
Some of them are attorneys and very and venerated, but they really terrible people. And they did terrible things, like Justice Taney. We'll get into that later.
Oh.
Who he wrote the Dred Scott decision. Do you know what that is?
No, like, no, I don't.
Dred Scott decision said that Afro-American people were property and
oh,
not humans.
Oh, my goodness.
They were property and you
that
could own
horrible.
Them and trade in them. Right. Like chips in the casino. Anyhow, we get to this thing about lawyers being disciplined much more by the courts, the bar associations, and then into the courts. And the judges are in a separate profession. They're not lawyers anymore. They're not acting as lawyers. They don't function as lawyers. They look at life differently than lawyers. And they criticize lawyers and they judge them.
They scrutinize basically their arguments.
And it's a wonderful thing. The independence of the judiciary is probably the greatest hope we have in our society right now, ever. And then when we start to lose it to politics, it's terrible.
Yes.
So that's this discussion, okay?
Okay. No, thank you, Lewis. I learned quite a bit. And
well, read the
I
book.
I look forward to more.
Thank you. And read my book, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. And then there's a new one
coming out. It's on Amazon, right?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. And there's a new one coming out, Miami Memoirs, that also has a lot of these stories. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lewis. And I look forward to the next one.